CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
This week's CFO Radio news, it comes to us from CFO.com, and it's around the topic, does growth require cash? Chuck Mulford dates the birth of his brainchild, a just-launched metric that he calls the free cash profile, to a conversation he had about 20 years ago with the chief executive officer of a very small company called Information Resource Engineering, IRE. Mulford, a Georgia Tech accounting professor whose passion is investing, saw IRE as a potential good stock to buy, and he did several elements of analysis and so forth and focused specifically on the cash. It took years, but Mulford, director of the Georgia Tech Financial Analysis Lab, molded his thinking into a single predictive metric that he believes can suggest a company's ability to generate or consume free cash flow as it grows. In a recent study of 44 non-financial industries, including 2,290 companies with annual revenues of more than $100 million, the lab's research found a median free cash profile of about 5%, 4.95% to be specific. In simplest terms, for every dollar of sales growth, most companies can be expected to throw off about 5 cents of free cash flow. To calculate the company's free cash flow profile, Mulford starts with what he calls as the core cash profile. This measures a company's capacity to generate core operating cash as it grows. He gets to that by subtracting the percentage of revenue represented by operating working capital from the percentage of revenue represented by operating cushion, which he defines as operating profit before non-cash depreciation and amortization. In essence, the core cash flow profile represents the amount of core operating cash flow that can be expected for any measured amount of growth, assuming that a firm's current mix of operating cushion and operating working capital stay approximately the same. To arrive at a company's free cash profile, Mulford subtracts the company's percentages of revenue represented by taxes paid and capital expenditures, and by eliminating taxes and capex, two expenditures that are typically expected to grow as sales grow, Mulford seeks a way to focus exclusively on the way growth affects a company's free cash flow. The free cash profile assumes that a firm's current mix of operating cushion and operating working capital and all the other items that we've described remain unchanged. That assumption helps anticipate the future cash flows by assuming things like margins, receivables requirements, and inventory are not going to change, says Mulford. A good starting point for any forecast is knowing what your steady state is. Despite the lab's findings, the typical company throws off at least some free cash flow as it grows. Not every company can expect to fund its own growth with the cash that growth generates. 18 industries, or 40% of the sample taken, had negative free cash profiles, but even in those industries, there are many firms with positives. The firms with positive free cash profiles enjoy higher operating cushions and are more adept at managing operating working capital and limiting spending than firms with negatives, said the lab's report. Looking at the current scene, Mulford has a particular admiration for Apple. The company, he observes, has generated so much cash as it has grown that it's drawn complaints from investors wanting some of the cash back. Recently, Google has shown to be particularly adept at generating cash as it grows, just as the slower-growing Microsoft once excelled. But unlike those two companies, Apple is a manufacturer with all the working capital requirements that implied by that, yet it's still able to amass a huge cash hoard. If they benchmark their company's free cash profiles against those of their peers, CFOs can gauge where their companies are likely to stand in the eyes of sharp investors, Mulford said. If you look at the investments that Warren Buffett likes, they tend to be companies with positive free cash profiles, he said. Not that he's used that term, but he knows how to find investments that can generate cash and grow at the same time. Well, moving on from cash, I would like to invite and introduce our guest, Linda Posner-Downing, is joining us today. Linda is a fraud auditor at the Department of Justice. Her role incorporates fraud investigations, financial analysis, auditing, internal controls, and government programs compliance in the healthcare industry. Prior to her present position, Linda was senior internal auditor for the St. Joseph's Candler Health System in Savannah, Georgia. While there, she investigated and reported to the audit committee of the board of directors, and her focus was auditing results and investigations using analysis of financial records, evaluation of public records, interviewing and assessing intelligence information. She initiated investigations based on continuous monitoring of financial and operational data and conducted investigations in response to compliance hotline tips as well as senior management requests. Linda has a Bachelor of Science in Accounting, an accounting degree from the University of South Florida and an MBA from Georgia Southern University. Well, wow, that's a lot of background, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Lorraine.
Well, wow, we've gone from a topic of news related to cash to the Department of Justice. And I am very particularly excited to have you on the show. I met you at a CFE, Certified Fraud Examiners event, I think 3, 4, 5 months ago. And just the work that you do, I think, sounds fun, exciting. Forensics tends to be the sort of sexy side of finance. So I want to really dig into that. But let's start at the beginning. What was your first job? Maybe were you a retail? Were you a paper mail clerk? Did you work in the post office? What was your first job?
Well, my first job actually has nothing to do with forensics. I was flipping burgers at a Burger King at age 15. But what kind of led me into this field was kind of a circuitous route. I obtained my undergraduate degree and knew I wanted to do something in business, just wasn't sure. And one of my beginning accounting classes, I had a kind of practicum where you had to figure out where the missing money was and kind of a fill in the blanks thing. And I really liked it and ended up getting an accounting degree for that reason and pretty much genetically programmed to do anything math-wise. So my first job out of school was actually at Photomat Corporation, which was called a shrinkage auditor. Photomat, as you know, had the kiosks where they sold camera equipment and film and so forth, and there were a lot of them, and they were always remotely located, which kind of lends itself to theft. And at that time, systems weren't really that well integrated, and we kind of had to determine, well, were the month-end balances the result of theft, or were they the result of just system errors and so forth? So that kind of got me started in the field of forensics before it was actually known as forensics. And from there, I had various jobs either as an internal auditor or a staff accountant, and realized pretty early in my career that strictly accounting was not something I wanted to do.
You had enough of closing the books, huh?
Yeah, that kind of cyclical thing, every month, the same kind of duties. And I like challenges. I like to find new ways to do things, maybe make improvements. And looking at the unknown, I'd probably do much better in a situation where I'm thrown in just blind and have to figure things out than just a very structured kind of detailed work assignment.
So your job today is very challenging, I'm assuming, and there's a lot of variety.
Challenging, a lot of variety, and absolutely no guidance. You have to be a motivated person, a go-getter, and just you really want to figure things out and just kind of tear through public records, tear through all the evidence that's there to figure out what's going on.
Well, your role, your title is fraud auditor. What exactly does that mean? What in the realm of us in finance and accounting, fraud can mean a lot of different things.
Well, it's funny you ask that, because my title, I think, is kind of changes. They actually asked me what I wanted my title to be when I came there. So I could have picked forensic accountant, forensic auditor, this or that. And I thought corporate fraud auditor was probably the best, because that pretty much encompasses what I do, more complex financial crimes. And those typically take place in the context of some kind of large organization.
So an Enron, a WorldCom, these kind of, obviously I'm not asking you to say whether you were on those particular cases, but those kinds of transactions.
Exactly.
Okay, so maybe somebody's going to face jail time.
they're always almost going to face jail time. If you are involved in any kind of federal crime, whether it's financial or non-financial, you're almost certainly looking at some jail time.
So within that, is part of your learning the legal aspects of the fraud?
Yes, I would say that I'm probably more financially savvy than I am legally savvy. In fact, we have somebody in our department who primarily focuses on drug crimes that involve money laundering. And she's not only is she a CPA, but she's also an attorney because there are so many legalities involved. And you really have to know, for instance, what you can do with wiretaps and what you can do with other things. And I don't have that background.
Wow, but that's a good person to know, huh?
Sure.
So tell me a little bit about the role of the Department of Justice as it relates to your position. I'm going to loosely say you get the bad guys, right? But what is the role of the DOJ?
The Department of Justice is basically an umbrella, and underneath that umbrella, there are lots of different agencies. The United States Attorney's Office, where I work, is the primary law enforcement agency of the Department of Justice. And then you have other law enforcement agencies, such as the FBI, the DEA, and I probably don't need to spell out those acronyms. Most people know what they are. INS, and all the way down, there's probably over 15 of them, and I couldn't name them off the top of my head. So they basically investigate cases and determine, is there going to be a crime, and bring those to us at any stage of an investigation, and we decide if we're going to go forward with prosecution.
So at what stage is brought to you? At what stage do you hear about this?
Well, there's really no rule for when I'll get a case. Sometimes somebody will walk in off the street and go, I've just been defrauded, and they'll just lay it all out there, and then they'll pull me in and say, you know, take a look at this evidence and see, has somebody been defrauded? And if so, we can formally open a case. Sometimes something has already been reported, for instance, to the IRS or the FBI or so forth, and maybe they don't have the expertise to handle it, and they get me involved at a very early stage. And so at that time, I'm going through financial records to determine who do we need to interview, what more needs to be done, or conversely, this really isn't a case. Sometimes the FBI agent or so forth has done a multitude of work, and there's really not much left for me to do but just summarize it. And then other times that the summarization has been done, and I just testify in court as a summary witness.
So your role essentially is taking the data, you do the analytics, the forensics, and so forth, but your result, if you will, is for purposes of a court case.
Correct.
Interesting. So tell me, what are your typical day-to-day activities then? Are you, you know, looking through reams of documents? Is it typically technology, computer-based work? Is it interviewing face-to-face? What exactly is your role?
Well, there again, it depends on when I've been asked to become involved in an investigation. So my day can change. I've never had the same day. Sometimes I'll be looking through what I call reams and reams of documents. I'm looking for that one email, that smoking gun, that we have all the financial evidence. It's certainly, you can certainly see that a crime has probably been committed, but until either somebody admits it to you or they've written it down in an email, we really can't say, well, that person knowingly committed a crime. So I'm just looking for that email and doing, we have different kind of Boolean searches in our database to try to find that one email from that one person with that one word in it that's going to get us what we want. Other times I use kind of an advanced software. I say advanced for people who don't use it, but it's probably not advanced for people who use it a lot. It's called ACL, Audit Command Language. And a lot of times your big companies, Coca-Cola and so forth, use this. And it's a way to just go through reams and reams of enterprise-wide data and try to figure out, you know, is there an anomaly? Has there been a crime committed? So I'll do things like that. And sometimes our corporations who bring us cases, they've already have their data in ACL, so they've already done that work. And so it's my job just to kind of verify it. Other times we are going to interview somebody, and so I'll pull documents and I'll kind of lay it out for the FBI agent. And so these are the questions to ask. These are documents that go with that question, and I'll sit in on the interviews and I let usually the prosecutor and the agent do the majority of the questioning, but I will follow up if I think the question hasn't been answered in a way that shows really financially what's going on, because sometimes our agents they don't have a financial background. So those are the times I would probably be more involved. And Other days, I'm just subpoenaing information. So I'm calling up people, calling up contacts sometimes I know in the industry. You know, can you help me get this information and try to get it turned around quickly? So,
do you ever have difficulty getting access to the company's information? Or is that based on you coming into a case, do you pretty much have full access to the technology and the data?
Companies that have been defrauded are generally very forthcoming with information. They literally bend over backwards to get us the information we want because it's in their best interest. They're oftentimes looking at restitution and they've got a bone to pick, so to say, with the employee maybe that defrauded them. So they'll pretty much do anything you ask of them. Sometimes our banks aren't always as cooperative as I'd like, and that may have something to do with, you know, some of the things going on today in the mortgage industry and the Department of Justice pursuit of that. So, and then it just depends on the individual at the end of the line who gets your call. Do they want to help you or do they not?
Sure. Well, do you actually appear in court?
I do testify in court as a summary witness. Some people confuse that with an expert witness. I'm not really an expert witness. It would be kind of a conflict for me to be an expert witness working for the government, but I am a summary witness.
What does that mean?
Basically, I have a CPA. I'm also a certified fraud examiner and a certified internal auditor. And so my summaries have a little bit of authenticity based on just my professional certifications. And so we'll present documents in court and hopefully the jury believes that because of my certifications, I kind of know what I'm talking about.
Sure. And in terms of your description of a summary, you're the one that's presenting maybe the facts of the case?
Typically, the prosecutor will ask the question, obviously already knowing the answer. And, you know, Ms. Downing, can you refer to Exhibit A? And what did you do here? And kind of spells it out in very, very layman's terms for people in the jury who might not have a financial background.
I see. So within that readiness for court, you're doing a lot of prep work with the prosecutors. You're kind of rehearsing.
Well, it's funny that you say that because some prosecutors won't even talk to me before a case. And the reason they do
they tend to win those ones?
Yeah, they do. All our prosecutors are pretty spot on, but they have a reason for why they do that because the jury can kind of see when a witness is being led and it will tend to have them not look at your testimony as
being so credible.
Correct. And so often, I mean, there's one prosecutor in particular that he hardly talks to me. I'll give him my summary documents and we'll incorporate those into the court exhibits. And sometimes when I'm on the stand, I have to ask him for clarification and just a surprise question that came. And afterwards, I want to say to him, why didn't you tell me you were going to ask me that question? Others will go over and they'll ask my opinion and we'll have more of a conversation. I wouldn't say they're trying to lead me, but they really want to know what I'm thinking because it's probably going to determine how they're going to ask the question.
Great. So one of the aspects of your role that you have to come to the table with, I guess I'm trying to get at, is you have to be a very good communicator. You have to be able to delineate a lot of facts into what you've described as simple language so that a non-financial person can understand it. Those are skills that, quite honestly, I don't know that necessarily all of us in the CPA, in the CFO world, necessarily come with.
Yeah, and don't forget, we don't want to put the jury to sleep either, because sometimes you do find that where the person's kind of nodding off, and so you kind of want to keep your testimony going that keeps them somewhat, you know, this isn't a television show, we're not, you know, this isn't CSI, we're not going to have any big dramatic things going on in the courtroom, so.
Oh, so it's not that not like that in real court?
No, however, I just finished a case where two-thirds of the way through the trial, we had a defendant who decided to represent himself. I guess he thought his verbal skills were so good and his knowledge of the law was so good, and it didn't really go that well for him. And 2 days probably before the trial was to end, he just flew out of town and just left. And so he was tried in absentia. So that was probably the most dramatic thing I've experienced.
That's fun. Well, let's talk a little bit about work that you do with other agencies. You've talked about the FBI, the DEA, and some of those other departments. As we look at fraud, there's the straight, I put cash in my pocket. And then there's a lot of corporate fraud that really I would describe as accounting fraud. Essentially, that is defrauding the public through manipulating the financial results, thereby manipulating the asset value to the shareholders and the potential investor public. How do you work? Well, perhaps first and foremost, which are the other agencies that you work with?
Well, typically I work with the postal inspectors, the United States Postal Service, because a lot of fraud is committed through the mail. So you have your mail fraud or your wire fraud. We often get cases through the Department of Labor. Sometimes you'll have, for instance, maybe an insurance agent that has defrauded the policyholder. So that would come through the Department of Labor. I've had cases come through the Department of Education where you have maybe a for-profit school here in our district that is getting federal money for the students and really not churning out any degrees. And it's kind of suspect, really, as to what's even going on with the school. Obviously, we have cases from the FBI, and they run the gamut. The FBI takes pretty much the brunt of the financial cases. And we also have cases from the IRS, obviously, any kind of tax evasion cases, things like that. And also the SEC with you just talked about with financial statement fraud. Those we tend to not get as many of those cases, but we do get some.
Interesting. So you're dealing with all these different agencies. How do you figure out which of the cases to take, or is that something kind of above your head?
Well, I wish I could say I could choose based on which interests me the most, but that's really not how it goes. There is a kind of a triage system where based on, I guess, the amount that they think the money that has been lost.
Kind of the risk associated with the case.
Right. Correct. And a lot of times it's just I think it's subjective. Maybe they have a formula that they haven't made me aware of. And other times we have joint meetings with the other agencies where we'll go over potential cases. And so we don't have duplication of effort. And we try to figure out which case do we think is going to lead to a successful prosecution.
Interesting. So what is your typical day-to-day connection? It sounds like they are bringing maybe a case to you, and then you do investigation work and then coordinate back with them for purposes of prosecution. Is that a fair description, or maybe you can meet out that, give us some meat on the bones on that?
That's a pretty fair description. More specifically, what happens is I would say I probably do more document review than most of our agents do. So I'll go through lots and lots of documents, and I'll determine, hey, I think there's a pattern here. I think there's a person here and so forth. And then I'll gather those documents. I'll give my advice or my opinion to the agent so that the agent can go out and interview that person. The agent will go out, then they'll report back. They don't report to me in a hierarchical kind of setting, but they will come back to me and say, this is what I found. I think this person's a no-go. I do think this person's a go. And so it's a very robust kind of situation.
And how long typically does a case take?
Too long. Financial crimes, this isn't like robbing a bank where somebody's going to leave some kind of DNA, whether it's a fingerprint or the dye is going to explode on them, and you can get a prosecution in 3 months. Financial crimes, they're tricky. And I mean, I've had cases that are still ongoing 3 years, and in a lot of times it's a challenge to get it indicted before the statute of limitations runs out. So they're very, very complex, and they take a long time.
And how long is that statute of limitations?
See, you're asking me a legal question.
I'm
a financial person.
Okay.
But I'm going to say it's an odd number, 3, 5, or 7 years.
Okay. Interesting. So I guess if you're going to do the crime, keep your fingers crossed that you go beyond the time limits, right?
Well, that's good advice if there's any criminals out there listening.
Well, hopefully there aren't. But part of why I'm looking at going through some of the detail of your background, there may be some listeners that have never even thought of this as a career and potentially could be interested. And then there are the CFOs that may be looking to do something tricky in the books, and they need to be aware of the fact that you're potentially out there and could come after. And then there are the CFOs that and the rest of the majority of the community that are just doing the right thing, but they may be one to be made aware of something inappropriate. Is it an appropriate question to ask you what they should do? I mean, do they first go to their CFO? Do they, you know, with whistleblower protection that's in place, do they go to somebody within the corporation? Do they get legal advice? Or is that something that you can perhaps suggest?
Well, I'd like to start by saying that with databases today and the information that you have, we have such a wealth of information in virtually every corporate environment. And you really should have what I call kind of continuous monitoring in place already, whether your upper management is doing it or whether your audit department is kind of initiating that. But virtually everything that I've found or crimes that I've seen could have probably been detected through some kind of computer-assisted auditing techniques or some kind of continuous monitoring, because just large transactions of data lend themselves to showing things that are out of whack. And so that would be, the prevention is obviously the best cure. By the time you get to detection, you know, you've already suffered a loss. And, you know, I hate to say it, but typically you don't recover those losses. Fraud losses are usually not recovered. If you have some kind of insurance policy that covers that sort of thing, you're looking at a pretty big upfront deductible. So, and I mean, I'll have to say investigation takes time, work, and money. And, you know, corporations are in business to make money, not to spend it on investigation. So
that would
kind of be my first suggestion.
So the restitution, if the company should be able to gain that, is really the comfort that they've got the bad guy and that somebody's maybe doing some jail time or some fines and penalties and that sort of thing.
Right. And you know, not to be a naysayer or anything, not every case, you can know that maybe a fraud has been committed, a crime has been committed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there are the resources to prosecute it either on the state level or the federal level. And only if it's maybe a super duper big crime is it going to be prosecuted, but that doesn't really make a CFO feel real good. Well,
no. And like you say, the cash is gone or the financial element, whatever it is that was the defraud.
Or the loss of trust with your public.
True. Very true. So, well, let's talk about how you mentioned systems and data. How do you incorporate systems into your daily job, and to what extent do you rely on data itself?
Well, honestly, I have a challenging time incorporating a lot of kind of IT systems in what we do, because we have so many different agencies that we deal with, and each of them operate under a different system. Whereas when you're with a corporation, you generally have an enterprise-wide system that pulls everything together for you and spits out these beautiful reports that makes analysis really easy. So we're doing some things right now where we're looking at what I call data mining, and they're kind of funny about wanting me to talk about it, because with the public, there's always that perception of what is the government doing.
Sure.
But we are trying to be more proactive, and we have monthly meetings with different agency heads from the various agencies that I talked about to kind of look at the data that's out there that we have, and, you know, what can we do to look at patterns and try to see if there's crimes going on nationwide instead of just in our own district.
So it might be fair to describe, in terms of your analytical skills, you're probably extremely spreadsheet database friendly. You can manipulate, and that's a requirement for your job.
It is. And not only that, I love to do it. I mean, it's funny, most people, they like to go to court and testify. I'd rather be doing data analysis.
You're the spreadsheet junkie, huh?
Pretty much.
So Excel, Access, are those some of the tools that you use?
I don't use those as much as I use ACL and some of our more, we have some enterprise-wide software that kind of allows you to do more and quicker.
More with more.
Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I actually used ACL, gosh, it was quite a few years ago, but when I was in internal audit, that was actually a software that I used, and it was actually pretty friendly, user-friendly, and you had huge data mining capacity. You could take massive, massive volumes of data, and it just, I mean, you essentially put in the formulae for what you were trying to look for, and it would spit out results.
Right, right. And I mean, I can tell you that I've found fraud just through ACL. I've done Benford analysis. I don't know if that's something you're familiar with or the public's familiar with, but it's basically looking at logarithms, and ACL builds that in, and it can tell you, particularly like with your accounts payable database, and you can find, you know, maybe with fake vendors have been set up and things like that. So it really allows some pretty sophisticated analysis.
That's fabulous. And just for the record, we're not sponsored by ACL. Maybe we should be.
Yeah, right.
So let's look at, I don't know whether you can talk about any particular cases, but just generically speaking, give us an example of a particular fraud. Is it always cash related? for you?
It's not always cash related. I would say when I was in the corporate world, most of the frauds were cash related. Maybe at a physician practice, they were embezzling cash, or we had a pharmacy where they were embezzling cash, things like that, or taking your more expensive drugs and selling them on the street. With the cases I have now, I mean, ultimately, yes, it involves cash, but it's more things. For instance, you might have somebody within a bank who has a lot of discretion, a lot of power, that maybe uses that to maybe do loans to people he or she knows. We have, for instance, insurance cases where somebody has an insurance company and they provide health insurance, and instead of using the premiums to buy policies for their policyholders, they just spend that on personal living expenses. So yes, in the end, it usually involves cash, but it's through different vehicles.
So it might be a second means of maybe subverting or using that cash in another manner. From an uneducated perspective, is that maybe somewhat akin to laundering?
No, we do have laundering, and that would typically be where somebody who gets their cash gets it from an illegal source. For instance, dealing drugs, or maybe selling black market goods or things like that. But money laundering is a totally separate issue.
Is there a separate department within the DOJ that manages that?
No, IRS is really big in looking into money laundering, because the whole purpose in money laundering is to not pay taxes. So they tend to take the lead in those kind of cases.
Sure. Interesting. So where does somebody like you go from here? It sounds like you have a fabulously exciting job. But 10, 20 years from now, what do you do? Do people like you maybe become consultants? And once you've got the gray hair going, do you become a consultant to the corporations to help them prevent this?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because most people, most normal people, have a very successful, maybe 30-year career in the government, which they then parlay into a very lucrative private industry job. Well, I did the opposite. I went from that kind of job to work with the government just because I love what I do and I wanted to do this full time, and I wanted all my work to be doing this. And, you know, some days I walk into work and I have to pinch myself and think, I can't believe I'm paid to do this, because I really love to do this. So right now, looking at going back into the corporate world, I mean, if I could be doing something I really, really loved, yeah, I would do it. But
you went there and you left it, right?
Correct. And there are some really nice things about working for the corporate world. For me, I'm very goal driven. And so any kind of money or, you know, kind of goals or objectives of the corporation, I can really buy into that and try to do what I can to help meet those goals, where government isn't so much like that. We have more of a mission that, you know, we have to serve the people, and the money and those kind of quantifiable goals aren't out there.
So let's if we can, talk a little bit more about some of the aspects of the court work that you do. That to me sounds like a lot of fun. There are many folks in the finance community that the financial analysis side of the world is what really they enjoy. But you've got an added bonus. You get to speak about it in a public arena. What was that like, first time getting into court? Were you nervous?
No, not really. I think maybe just my nature. I really enjoy things that are new, things that are challenging, unforeseen. If I have to come in and I know what's expected of me day after day after day, I'm probably not going to be real happy doing that. So no, I really don't get nervous.
So how do you prepare for court?
Well, it depends who the prosecutor is. If it's a prosecutor that I've had a lot of contact with, you know, I'll probably go over maybe some of the depositions that he or she has taken to try to get a feel for how they ask questions, how things roll. But if it's a prosecutor that I haven't had a lot of contact with, I'm on my own. So, and most of the preparation is just knowing the work I did and having a confidence level in the work that I did, that when the defense is going to cross-examine me, and they will, and, you know, where are the holes that they could potentially find. And so maybe trying to prepare for any kind of weaknesses, if there are any weaknesses.
So how much of your time is in the courtroom versus outside of the courtroom?
Really, very little time is in the courtroom. For instance, a case that just was adjudicated, we might have investigated the case for 2 to 3 years, trial prep, right leading up to trial, maybe have been 2 weeks, and I might testify for 25 minutes, cross-examine for 5 or 10.
Wow. So 5 or 10 minutes of cross-examination for a case that you spent a couple of years managing.
Right.
Wow. So how long does it take typically for that all to come to restitution? Is it once the court case starts, are they short cases?
You know, typically financial crimes cases are not short. You have a lot of documents that you have to bring into the courtroom, and there's a protocol for doing that to entering an exhibit. And, you know, frankly, they're big exhibits. I mean, you might have bank statements that are hundreds and hundreds of pages long with the matching checks. I mean, that's just one account. So that's all very tedious. And there's the boredom factor for your jurors.
I understand. Absolutely. And in finance, we're not known as being the comedians in the group. So yeah.
Right.
So is there an aspect to your job that do you learn the communication styles? Does somebody help guide you as to how to present yourself beyond the prosecutors?
No, typically when I'm testifying, I'll continue to glance over at the jurors. If I start to see the head bob and things like that, I'll try to change my demeanor. If they're looking at me kind of with a quizzical look on their face, I'll know that maybe I'm speaking in language I shouldn't be speaking. Or if they're kind of looking at me, giving me the look, you must think I'm an idiot, then I'll change
it up a bit.
Correct. So yeah, it's kind of an ongoing, you just have to be aware of your audience. And for instance, I was just participating in an interview of a witness a couple weeks ago. And there was a time that I didn't work outside the home. I was a stay-at-home mom and I would go into my son's classroom and help with some of the kids who had some developmental issues. So I kind of got to know those kind of tics that these kids had. And when we were interviewing this person, I could tell this was a person, even though he was very, very, he was a successful financial person, he probably had some of these communication skills. And it was really tripping up the prosecutor who was asking him questions that, and finally we had to go out of the room and I had to say to him, I really think he's confused. I think you need to change your line of questioning. So yeah, it's communication skills. You just have to be aware of your audience.
Understand. Well, we have a tradition on the show to ask all of our guests the CFO tip of the month. I'm not quite sure what you're going to come up with based on your role, but based on the perspective of your role, what is your tip of the month?
My tip of the month is if to definitely contact your elected officials. Any kind of public servant is out there. They're there to serve you. And if you have questions, if you have comments, or you want to be heard, they're there for you. So I would really recommend, we live in this great democracy, to do that.
And I guess you're paying taxes such that that's what taxes are going towards,
right? That's
right. So use your tax payments wisely. Well, that's a great tip. I'd like to thank you, Linda Posner-Downing, for being our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO and the underrole of the fraud that sometimes takes case. Thanks also go to our contributor, CFO.com, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, please go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks also go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website can be found at www.financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks to listening to us to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.